He started making mistakes, said Nightingale. Something has put him off his game, and if he's scrambling, we might be able to bring him down with a good tap. He is making mistakes, I thought. But why? Yes, Reynard and Christina had pilfered his goodies from under his nose. But I couldn't see any connection between that and Aidan Burley, especially not one which warranted that flashy dismemberment. And what was he doing, questioning Phoebe in her underground pool? Unless the faceless man was her father, Jeremy Beaumont Jones, and he thought Aidan Burley was another link in a conspiracy that encompassed Christina Chorley and Reynard the Suspicious. In which case, Olivia McAllister Thames would be a target too. We need to close down the other loose ends, I said.
Agreed, said Nightingale. Let's see how Sara's doing.
So we divvied up the jobs, subject to Sewall's agreement, of course. Gulid would action a TIE on the area manager who'd interviewed Wanda the manageress for her job. I'm sure Carey will have finished with his escorts by then, she said. Then both of us would head out to the fabled lands beyond High Wycombe to see whether Christina stashed her stolen goodies at her father's house.
Isn't Martin Chorley on the tiger list? Asked Gulid.
Our targets made a big thing out of his anonymity, I said. So, assuming for a minute that he is Christina's dad, which is unlikely but possible, then he's not going to reveal himself just because we want to look at his daughter's room, especially if we let him know we're coming up.
Gulid frowned. It's bad practice to give people warning before you turn over their house. But if Martin Chorley was the faceless man, I reckon the room would have been cleaned out by now anyway. It's also bad practice to startle dangerous armed suspects. Better to slowly and calmly take control of the situation. At least, that's the theory.
He's not going to blow his cover if he thinks he can fob us off, I said. And if he's not our man, then he won't know what we're looking for, so he won't have a reason to hide it.
Nightingale offered to authorize Gulid to carry a taser, but she claimed to have never done the training course.
In that case, you might want to carry a screamer instead, said Nightingale.
As long as you carry one too, I said. What's a screamer? Asked Gulid.
I said I'd show her when we got back to the folly, because Post Martin wanted us to cart a couple of crates over there and lock them in our secure evidence room. Actually, he meant the library, because there was no way he wanted his books stashed downstairs in the basement armory.
Molly came out to meet us as we drove in the back gate. She glared at me, and then tilted her head up towards the top floor of the coach house, where I keep my widescreen, my desktop, and any other bits of technology that, for one reason or another, don't work well in the folly proper. We left the boxes in the car, and me and Gulid climbed the spiral stairs to find Caroline inside, playing Shadow of Mordor on my PS4. Toby was curled up at her feet, thus once again demonstrating his true worth as a guard dog.
Thank God you're here, she said, putting it down. I was about to go mad with boredom.
I did a quick inspection of my stuff, but nothing seemed out of place. I haven't got so paranoid that I've started sticking hairs across door jams, but between Nightingale watching the rugby while I was over at Bev's, and Molly sneaking in whenever she thought I wasn't looking to swap recipes on Twitter, I've taken to securing anything important in filing cabinets. I asked how long she'd been hanging out on her own.
We came over to talk to your experts, said Caroline, who made it clear she'd been dragged over as reluctantly as any child to an art gallery.
Despite tea and cakes, Caroline thought she'd just about reached peak boredom when Professor Postmartin was called away.
You're not interested in the third Principia? I asked.
It's not going to have anything about aerodynamics in it, she said, is it?
Aerodynamics? Asked Gulid.
Caroline wants to fly, I said.
Does she know about your swan dive off the top of Sky Garden Tower? Asked Gulid.
She does now, I thought.
The one that was blown up, said Caroline.
As it came down, said Gulid, who wasn't making any friends just then.
I busily rooted around in the equipment rack for a couple of screamers, while Caroline fished for information. Had I actually been flying, or gliding, or otherwise retarding my fall through the use of magic? And if so, how?
Retarding, I said, while I checked that the screamers were working. Only it was the faceless man doing it, not me.
I handed the screamer to Gulid and showed her how to use it. Caroline wanted to know whether I'd seen how the faceless man was controlling his descent, and I remembered the tower falling, the screaming, the smell of brick dust, and the whole wide world rushing up to smack me in the face. I was a bit distracted at the time, I said, but he had to concentrate to maintain it. So what happened to Dr. Walid and Lady Helena, said Gulid, who always liked to keep things moving along. After the professor rushed off, your pair of mad pathologists asked my mum whether she'd like to see their unparalleled collection of horrible things, Caroline said. She explained that she hadn't really fancied it herself. She would have done a bit of exploring around the folly, only Molly kept on following her, so she came into the yard and found the tech cave. It wasn't locked, I said. No, she said and smiled innocently. Was it supposed to be? Generally, I keep it locked. I chivied her out and she ended up helping me and Gulid carry the boxes of books up to the library. Anything in these for Mum? Asked Caroline. She can take it up with the professor, I said. But that's when I decided to take Caroline with us to check Christina Chorley's room. It was all going perfectly fine until I noticed Martin Chorley's watch. After that, as Nightingale might say, it all went rather downhill. The Chorley house was just the other side of Lane End, itself a village just the other side of High Wycombe, which could, I suppose, be described as a small town just the other side of London. Since we'd managed to catch the M40 during a rare moment of decongestion, we made it there in less than an hour, not counting the stop-off at Marks and Spencer's for snacks. We checked the location on Google Earth, so unless there'd been some drastic landscaping in the last couple of years, the house had two L-shaped wings and was situated just below the brow of a wooded hill that overlooked the valley and the motorway that snaked through it. It was reached by a private driveway that peeled off the main road and looped up through the woods. Martin Chorley certainly liked his privacy. We stopped off at the entrance to the drive for a quick pre-arrival conference and the last of the Percy Pigs. I didn't want Caroline to come up to the house. On the remote chance he is the faceless man, I said. Then he might know about you and your mum. Better if he doesn't know we're working together. You expect me to wait in the car? Said Caroline. Actually, no, because we're going to park the car right outside, I said. I thought you could wait in the pub we went past back there. Back there? Said Caroline. About 500 metres, I said. It looked like they did food. And you didn't think to stop when we went past? I didn't think of it until we got here, I said. Look, we'll drive you back down the road and come back. I expected a longer argument, but Caroline gave me a look, put up her hands and said she'd walk. Can you bag us a table for when we're finished? I asked, as she started back down the road. She didn't answer. And that was in aid of what, exactly? Asked Gulid. I don't trust them, I said. I don't trust her or her mother. I couldn't leave her rattling around the folly, and I definitely don't want her getting first dibs on anything Christina has stashed at her dad's house, particularly if she had a copy of the third Principia. You think Caroline would try and steal it? Asked Gulid. Believe it, I said. What does Nightingale think? Maybe he just likes having someone to talk shop with, but he seems a bit too trusting to me. Maybe he's picked up some bad habits, said Gulid. Yeah? Who from? Gulid looked down the road, to where, despite the curve, we could just see Caroline trudging back towards the village. Is there some reason why we're still standing here? She asked. I want to make sure she doesn't double back, I said. Also, she might fly. I got out of the Asbo for a better look. When you're finished, I'll be in the car, said Gulid. Disappointingly, Caroline didn't launch herself into the air, so I climbed back into the car and we drove up the winding drive to Chorley Central. It was a beautiful house, if you like, fine, detached William and Mary villas in the middle of nowhere. Still had lots of its original features, and I was surprised it wasn't at least Grade 2 listed, but that hadn't shown up on the IIP check during the initial stages of the investigation. It had a nice, sensible tarmac drive, with discreet drainage channels built into verges. Not that they were going to flood this far up a hill, but Bev would have approved.
Checking the roof, I spotted solar panels on the south-facing slopes and was willing to bet the gutters directed rain into storage barrels against the possibility of hosepipe bans. I pulled up next to the BMW 5 Series that was parked outside the garage that made up the ground floor of the barn conversion next door. Presumably, the Ferrari 288 GTO, also registered in Martin Chorley's name, was kept inside. I spotted what definitely looked like an office attached to one end of the garage and made a mental note to check it, if only to sneak a look at the Ferrari. "What do you think?" asked Galeed as we approached the door. "Puzzled but cooperative," I said. "Resigned but obstructionist in a passive-aggressive fashion," said Galeed. "That's very precise. I've done more notifications than you," she said, and rang the doorbell. It turned out we were both wrong. Martin Chorley, knowing we were coming, had had time to clean the kitchen, tidy the living room, and hide his porn stash. I'm kidding about the cleaning because after 5 seconds in that house, it's clear he had a cleaner in 3 days a week at the very least. He looked less haggard when he opened the door, the smudges under his eyes having receded and the pain lines around his mouth seemed less prominent. It looked like he was beginning to settle into his grief, but there was a feverish aspect to his eyes that I didn't like. He was dressed in khaki chinos and a white and black check shirt with the sleeves rolled up to his elbows. There was a smudge of something black, oil or ink, I couldn't tell which, on his left shoulder. "Please," he said when he saw us. "Come in. Make yourselves at home." Galeed gave him a sharp look. "Can I ask how you're feeling, sir?" said Galeed. Martin Chorley gave her a puzzled glance, then shrugged. "Bloody awful," he said. "But thank you for asking." The entrance hall was low-ceilinged, made lower by the original roof beams that crossed it. There was a staircase with bare wooden risers varnished a dark brown, leading upstairs, a square archway with what I learnt later was called the snug, with a real fireplace, old leather furniture, and the sort of worn throw rug that really needed to have an Irish wolfhound curled up asleep on it. I glanced at the staircase and Galeed took up the cue, asking whether we could see Christina's room first. "Mr. Chorley was welcome to supervise," she said, although in reality we were both hoping he didn't. In the end, he led us upstairs to the first floor, where the hallways were covered in a thick cream carpet that must have been a bugger to clean. "She pretty much had the run of this floor," he said. Although officially the main bedroom with its ensuite was hers, and the other rooms were for guests. Then he left us to it, thank God, and said that when we were finished, there was coffee in the kitchen. The main bedroom and bathroom were far too neat. The modern reproduction brass bed was neatly made. A ghastly pink vanity and matching wardrobe had their drawers closed, and when we opened them to look inside, we found the clothes neatly folded, even the underwear. Galeed tutted. The room had been practically scrubbed clean, probably since Christina's death. That was odd. Grieving parents often put off making any changes to a lost child's things. But grief smacks everyone in the face a different way, so I didn't read anything into it. There was no schoolwork. Presumably that had all been in her dorm room back at St. Paul's. But there was an interesting collection of books, lots of YA in the American Drown the Sister School of Social Realism, plus various Mallory Blackmans, Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in the Castle and Land of Laughs by Jonathan Carroll. "A bit more goth than I was expecting," said Galeed, and I remembered that we'd collared Reynard in that gothic paradise in Archway. Perhaps that's what they had in common. "There's nothing under the bed, inserted into the mattress or taped into an envelope under the knicker drawer. The lone stuffed animal propping up the headboard had no suspicious lumps, zips or loose seams, and valuable 17th century magical artifacts were definitely not lodged under any loose floorboards." We widened our search, softly stepping out into the corridor and moving as quietly as possible into the bathrooms and guest bedrooms. It's not that we were creeping about, but we figured what Mr. Chorley didn't hear us doing wouldn't worry him. Us police are thoughtful that way. We also have no shame. So once we found nothing of note on the first floor, we split up. Galeed to check the second floor, where Mr. Chorley had his domain,
while I went downstairs to keep an eye on the man himself, and, with a bit of luck, look at his motor. I found him in the kitchen where he offered me tea, but I asked if I could see the garage. He asked if I liked cars, and when I said I did, he gave me a wan but genuine smile. "Then you're going to like this," he said. The garage was clean, and judging from the perfectly balanced temperature and humidity, had the sort of environmental control system that Post-Martin demands for his most fragile historical documents. The brickwork was painted a bright glossy white, with just the Pirelli calendar and an immaculate tool rack to break up the sterility. All the better for us to appreciate the car. The Ferrari was a ridiculously beautiful motor. Firebrick red with proper, sleek 1970s sci-fi lines, so that it looked like any second the wheels would fold down to become lift engines and the vehicle would launch itself back to the future that never was. It also had a completely insane D-board 2.8-litre V8 engine that could do 0 to 100 in less time than it takes to say it. And from the point of view of the Magic Police, no electronic transmission, which meant you couldn't accidentally wreck your own motor when in hot pursuit. I'm not saying that Nightingale should have traded in the Jag, but would it really have killed him to lay down a couple of Italians from the golden age of supercars? Just as an investment, if nothing else. I asked Mr. Chorley if he ever took it out for a spin. "Absolutely," he said. "There's no point in owning a car like this if you never drive it." I was just wondering if there was a way I could wangle a ride, or, failing that, just go in the driving seat with the engine on, when Martin Chorley checked his watch. It was a slim, steel-coloured Mont Blanc Time Walker. $2,000 in change from reputable stockists, and the sort of high-quality wind-up that any practitioner would be proud to wear. I literally nearly shat myself. I was suddenly certain that I was bonding over a motor with the faceless man. And if it was him, then he already knew who I was, which meant that either he was just playing with me or was still hoping to maintain his cover. I considered whether I could tackle him right then, but he was fast and ruthless, and if I didn't take him down with the first blow, I probably wasn't going to get a second attempt. He didn't turn his back on me or lift the engine cover and conveniently bend over so I could concuss him with the first blow. And to be totally honest, I bottled him, which surprisingly is approved police procedure. Evacuate, report, and contain. That's what I was gonna say in the ever-expanding Falcon Operations Manual, assuming I lived long enough to finish writing it. I sighed, trying not to make it theatrical, and said I would love to stay and talk about cars, but we had to get back to London. He asked whether we'd found anything useful, and I explained that we hadn't, but you had to cross your I's and dot your T's. "I'm just pathetically grateful you haven't closed the case," he said. I assured him the full might and majesty of the Metropolitan Police was focused on finding the truth behind his daughter's death. If he would like a family liaison officer to be assigned to him, I'd be happy to oblige. And I was thinking that now I understood the ferocity with which Aidan Burley had been dismembered, not because he was an obstacle or as a warning to others, but because Martin Chorley held him responsible for his daughter's overdose. Damn, but Phoebe must have been seconds from death. The arrival of the Americans had saved her life. He shook my hand. His palm was warm and dry, his grip firm, but not macho. A salesman's shake, a grifter's shake, a psychopath's handshake. He gestured for me to precede him through the garage door. A line of sweat ran down my back as I turned away and stepped outside. "I'll just call my colleague and let her know we're going," I said, and thought, shit, 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 overthinking it, stupid, stupid, stupid. I pulled out my phone and called Gulid. "Yeah, they need us back at Belgravia," I told her. The garage was parallel to the back edge of the house, and there was a good 6 meters of drive between me and the Asbo. I lurched at a sudden grinding sound, but it was only the motorized garage door closing. I disguised it by converting it into a half-turn and cheery wave for Mr. Chorley, who stayed by the garage and watched me go. Ahead of me, Gulid sauntered out of the front door and over to the Asbo, where she leaned against the bonnet. She raised her hand in a lazy salute, aimed behind me so presumably it was for Mr. Chorley, who I deduced was still watching me go. I slipped my keys out of my pocket, and without pointing them at the car or doing anything else obvious, I pressed the unlocking remote. Nothing happened. I tried again, and still no clunk or bleep or flashing taillights. Either the remote had chosen that exact moment to break, or the electrics in my car had been nobbled. No prizes for guessing which. And that meant the fucker had disabled the Asbo while me and Galeed had been upstairs in his daughter's room. My guess was that in his head, I was going to point my fob at the car. It would fail, I would click it again and again before futilely trying the door handles. How he would chuckle. As puzzlement turned into stricken realization, I would look over at him and our eyes would meet. Then he would strike. Nothing fatal to start with, so probably Impello to knock me down, or something fancy and fifth order that I'd not even heard of. The way the Asbo was parked meant that there was a 2 meter gap between the driver's side door and the corner of the house. So, 2 meters to put us out of his line of sight. Once we'd managed that, I'd worry about what to do next. I picked up my pace. I didn't want our friend getting impatient and kicking off early. I called out something to Galeed, but I can't remember what I said. It was enough to get her off the bonnet and meet me in front of the car. There, we stopped as if having a quick chat before leaving. Martin Chorley's the faceless man, I said. Galeed's eyes widened and her head jerked back as if trying to escape the news. But she kept her body language neutral and disguised her reaction with a tolerably convincing laugh. Shit, she said. Nightingale is an hour and a half away. Does Chorley know we know? I think so, I said. Plan? I'm going to walk to the car, I said. You keep going round the corner until you're out of sight, then chuck the screamer and run like crazy. What are you going to do? I'm going to do exactly the same thing but in a different direction, I said. I'll keep him occupied, you organise the perimeter. If Galeed was going to say anything along the lines of, no, no, I can't let you sacrifice yourself for me, it was too late because we'd reached the car, and in any case, she knew it had to be this way. Careful not to look, I heard the temper of her sensible shoes, as once out of Mr. Chorley's sight, she took off towards the tree line. I took out my key fob and pointed it at the car. Nothing happened. I made a show of trying it a couple of times more, tried the handle, and then, with a quick prayer to Sir Samuel, the patron saint of policemen, I looked back at Mr. Chorley. He was standing in front of the garage, hands casually in his pockets. He nodded amiably at me, and I saw his eyes flick to my right. He was wondering where Galeed had gone, and while he was distracted, I gave him everything I had. Now, I'm not up to Nightingale standards, and 100 millimeters of case-hardened steel is a bit beyond me. But I have progressed a bit from the first time we met on a rooftop in Soho, when the faceless fucker snatched my fireball out of the air. A flash git. What he got was a flash gun bright fireball followed by an Impello Palmer. The idea is that the target spends all his time worrying about the bright light coming at his face and doesn't notice the invisible wall of force rushing along at waist height. It might have worked, for all I know, but I didn't stick around to find out. As soon as the spells were loosed, I turned and legged it for the trees. You don't run straight away from someone with a ranged weapon unless you want to get shot in the back. You're supposed to zigzag at random intervals to present a constantly shifting target. It's one of those things I've always known intellectually, but fuck me, it's difficult to do in practice. So I went left, as if I was trying to get out of sight around the house, and then right, picking a number at random and counting down the paces. 11, 10, 9, and then a horrid thought, maybe 11 was too high, so I turned at 6, and had gone one pace when something huge and orange shot past my head, close enough for the wind of it to stagger me. As I recovered, I looked up long enough to see the Asbo go tumbling into the trees,
splintering branches and spinning around as the front clipped the trunk of a full-grown oak. I thought I'd been running flat out, but, you know, I think now I added a couple of kilometers an hour and shaved some time off the world record. I feinted right again, went left, and suddenly I was in amongst the trees and the undergrowth and running downhill towards the main road. The previous summer, I'd done the exact same thing while being chased by an invisible unicorn, so at least I had form. I fumbled my screamer out of my jacket pocket, pressed my thumb hard against the activation slot, and threw it as far as I could to the left. The hardy men of the Bow Street Runners were used to working alone and thus relied on a loud voice to raise the hue and cry, alert the populace, and occasionally scream with pain as they were savagely beaten by a criminal gang. The new men of Peel's innovative civilian police force were, in contrast, equipped with the latest in communications gear, the hand rattle. A peeler could summon aid by shaking his rattle while in hot pursuit of a felon and hoping that people would stop laughing long enough to help. The rattle was soon superseded by the whistle, whose principal advantage was that not only could you have a number of prearranged signals for a variety of situations, but you didn't look like a total tit using it. Once the telephone had been invented, it was only a matter of time before the police got in on the new technology. And first in Glasgow, and then in London, the police box was born. Here, a police officer in need of assistance could find a telephone link to Scotland Yard, a dry space to do paperwork, and in certain extreme cases, a life of adventure through space and time. Finally, radios got small enough that a constable on the beat could carry one on his person, call in backup, report crimes, and lie about how long he was taking on refs. Then we got airwaves, which could be integrated with every other emergency service network all over the country. Now, a copper under threat can get help anywhere from anyone. There's even a panic button that opens your mic and broadcasts everything it picks up over the emergency channel. It's the sort of thing that saves the lives, and even more frequently the tender parts, of police officers. But then along comes magic, and suddenly we're supposed to go back to rattles and whistles. Not this PC. I like my tender parts abrasion-free. So I invented the screamer, patent pending. Built around the guts of a disposable mobile phone, it has a felt cover for grip and is weighted for throwing. It's got a recessed hook slide. You thumb it sideways and release, and a clockwork timer starts. Then you throw the bloody thing as far as you can, hopefully outside the area of immediate magical effect, where 2 minutes later, it basically phones the Met control room and screams, "Help! Help! Serious magic shenanigans here! Send help! Preferably Nightingale!" I have a guy in Leinster who makes them for me, although he still thinks I'm using them to track UFOs. As the screamer went flying into the undergrowth, I shifted axis again, caught my ankle on something unseen, and collapsed, flailing into the bushes. Against my instincts, I stayed down, face pressed against the layer of decomposing leaves that Beverly assures me is a vital part of the arboreal ecosystem, and forced myself to take deep and regular breaths, even as random spores made my nose tickle. There was wind in the treetops, and I heard a vehicle go past no more than 20 meters downhill. The main road. The trees around me were tall, with straight trunks supporting wide deciduous canopies. Judging from the variation in color and density, there are at least two or three different species, not that I could identify them. Their lowest branches were too high up for me to climb, and apart from the bush I was lying behind, there was little ground cover. I considered bolting for the road, but then what? This wasn't a unicorn I was dealing with. Martin Chorley wasn't going to be stopped by any landscape feature short of a 3 meter concrete wall. And even then it would only slow him down for 2-3 seconds tops. Better, I decided, to rely on stealth. At least until I had a better idea of where he was. "Peter," said a voice far too close by. "This really is an exercise in futility." It sounded like Martin Chorley, only richer and with a timbre of confidence that posh people put on to convince themselves they know what they're talking about.
There was money in that voice, and breeding. And behind it all, the mace, the whip, the bowler hat. I also didn't think it was entirely natural.
"I've done a deal with Leslie," said the voice. "I promised that no permanent harm will come to you."
It seemed very close now, meters, spitting distance. He had to know that I got a message out, and that it was only a matter of time before Nightingale descended on him in all his glory. Likewise, he had to know that it was goodbye, faceless man. Hello, plain old Martin Chorley, nominal and prime suspect.
"Look, Peter," said the voice, "I don't have all day, so why don't we get this over with?"
How not to be seen, lesson number one. Don't stand up. It started to rain. A persistent, invisible drizzle that worked its way through the canopy and started soaking the back of my jacket and trousers. What with being overcast, it was beginning to get dark, and I wondered who that would favour, me or him.
"We both know the only reason you're still alive," said Martin Chorley, a couple of centimetres from the back of my head, "is because I have a soft spot for Leslie May."
God, it was hard not to move. But I knew that Nightingale could throw sounds about the place. And if Chorley really had been behind me, I doubted he would have been so chatty.
"What I don't understand, Peter," said Martin Chorley, but now his voice seemed to be coming from a spot 3 or 4 meters to my right, "is your loyalty to these institutions, the police, the folly. You swore an oath to the crown, for God's sake. Institutions with hardly the best track record with regards to you people."
"Because the alternative is you," I wanted to shout back. But the second lesson on how not to be seen is don't answer back. He knows he's short of time, so he's trying to provoke me, I thought. Next, escalation. Threaten somebody else.
"I've got your Muslim partner," he said.
And this time I spotted the voice wow-wowing back and forth through the trees. I thought I might even be able to sense just a little the form he was using to do it.
"You have a reputation for gallantry. Are you prepared to do the gallant thing now?"
Now, he might have Galeed, although I doubted it, but even if he did, I knew he wasn't just going to swap her for me. He was going to try and provoke a response so he could zero in on me. And if he did have Galeed, I thought it better to establish the facts before I started worrying about that. I decided to give him a response. Lux is really the most ridiculously versatile of the Formi, and it has been the subject of experimentation by literally thousands of practitioners since the folly was a bunch of like-minded weirdos and charlatans meeting at a London coffee house. As a result, a young person with an inquiring mind could find the most extraordinary things written in the margins of his textbooks. Now, I have the advantage over my 19th century peers of knowing what infrared is and how it relates to imparting heat energy to a small cloud of gas so that it expands with a humorous farting sound. Oh, how they must have laughed. Thus, I can make my farting sound louder and funnier, to the point where it can shake the branches on a small bush. Ipsa scientia potestas est. I call them noisemakers because I haven't thought of a decent Latin tag yet. So, I flipped one as far to my right as I could, where it made a sound like deflating bellows and made a bush shake. Let's see what you make of that, I thought. A tree 5 meters to my right exploded. I was looking right at it when the trunk shattered at head height and blew out in a cloud of pale brown dust and splinters. Even as I clamped my arms over my head and tried to burrow my way into the leaf mold, chunks of wood were thudding down around me. I yelled into the ground as a heavy bit bounced off my back. Another tree exploded. Closer. I knew it was a tree because I heard the top half of the trunk crash through the surrounding branches before smashing into the hillside, with a sound that went vibrating up through my chest. A third explosion followed the crash so quickly that the sound became one long physical blow. A fourth and a fifth followed, but further away to the right, below the pain threshold. I risked lifting my head a fraction. The air was full of yellow and brown dust and the sick smell of broken wood. Flames were visible through the murk, licking up the shattered stump of a tree. Less than 10 centimeters from my face, a rough splinter the size and pointiness of a fence post had been driven into the ground. I couldn't stay where I was. Martin Chorley might not know I was here, but one more near miss by whatever he was exploding trees with and I was going to look like an involuntary hedgehog. I drew my legs up and braced to scramble towards the road. Another couple of explosions, much further to my right. Sometimes, courage is easy. And sometimes you have to scream at your own body to act in its own bloody best interest. And sometimes it refuses the call altogether. And the pisser is you never know which one it's going to be until you try. This time my body was in full agreement with flight mode, and off we went. We got maybe 5 meters before a weight landed on my back, wrapped something solid around my chest and hoisted me into the air. I would have screamed like a little girl, but whoever had a grip on me had their hand clamped over my mouth. There was the scent of saffron, the sharp bite of clean sunlight over a windswept hillside, and the sight of far horizons. You lying little tow rag, I thought. You can fly. The soaring effect was ruined by the leafy twigs that smacked me around my head and shoulders. And then we stopped in a green space, and I was dumped onto a branch next to the tree trunk, which, while being alarmingly thin at this altitude, I grabbed hold of gratefully. Caroline's hand squeezed my mouth for emphasis before letting go. I looked around. Caroline sat casually, legs swinging on a branch on the opposite side of the trunk, and Gulid was on a branch a meter below. We were near the top of the tree and the branches below us had been bent back up to create a sort of natural hide. Suspiciously, none of them had broken in the process, and I couldn't see any string or wire holding them in place. I looked at Caroline, who gave me a bland look in return. Then I flinched at a nearby explosion, then another, and another, and then two more, moving away. We sat in terrified silence for another half an hour, but heard nothing more. The likelihood was that Martin Chorley had cut his losses and scarpered, but none of us felt like betting our lives on it. Besides, he could have left booby traps and or weird hybrid things behind. So we waited quietly in the gathering dark for someone to come along and rescue us. Chapter 13. Angry Birds. We waited largely in silence and stillness, except for a furious, unvoiced argument about whose turn it was next to play Angry Birds on Caroline's phone, which only really ended when the phone in question buzzed and we got a text saying, "You may alight whenever you feel ready." "He took his time," I said. "Does this happen a lot?" asked Caroline. "Nope," I said. "Sometimes Beverly rescues me. Sometimes Lady Ty, occasionally Molly. I think there's a rota." "Shit," said Caroline. "You're not joking, are you?" "Don't be daft," I said. "Not really a rota. We're not that well organized." Gulid snorted. Caroline carried Gulid down first, just wrapped an arm around her chest and stepped off into thin air. It was hard to tell in the dark, but it looked to me like they dropped smoothly and at a steady pace. As they fell, the branches that had been curled over to hide us from the ground began to unbend and return to their original positions. When I told Bev about that later, she said that was more impressive than the flying. "Would not be notably motile," she said. When it was my turn, I closed my eyes and tried to get the sense of the former Caroline was using. When you're learning a new former, it can take dozens, sometimes hundreds of demonstrations before you can even start to replicate it in your mind. But you can still learn something from a brief encounter, if you pay attention. Not that this was easy. When you're dropping 20 meters with nothing holding you up but Caroline's contempt for the laws of motion. I felt it, floating in the non-space, where these abstractions catch hold of the fabric of the universe. And it was different. I mean, really different. Now, I knew there were different magical traditions, but I'd always assumed they shared common characteristics. Sensing the former Caroline invoked to defy gravity was like listening to Yusuf Latif take his flute into the pentatonic scale. Still music, still beautiful, but a whole new landscape of sound. "Can you truly fly?" I asked. She paused once our feet had settled and whispered in my ear. "Not yet," she breathed. "Soon, though. And then I will be away and free." "Away from what?" I wondered. "And free from who?" Nightingale was waiting for us at the bottom of the tree, wearing the oyster-coloured Burberry coat that is the closest he's ever going to get to a high-vis jacket. "How did you find us?" I asked. "In the first instance, the screamers worked as advertised," said Nightingale. "Then there were your texts. Beyond that, it was just a matter of following the trail of destruction." Up the hill, there were flashing blue lights visible through the trees. Galeed chivied Caroline towards the waiting paramedics, while she protested she was fine, which wasn't the point. As a civilian mixed up in a police operation, we had to be able to prove she was uninjured, so she couldn't sue us later. "You understand the implications of Martin Chorley being the faceless man," said Nightingale. "Which one?" I asked, and shivered. "The revenge aspect," he said. "There's a definite cause for concern there." "No shit," I said, and held my right hand in front of my face. There was definitely a tremble. "Did you warn everyone?" "Phoebe is with Olivia at Tyburn's house, but I lost Reynard when the screamer alerted me and I had to divert here," he said. "Gone to ground, no doubt." I stopped walking towards the lights and looked around. What was left of the orange asbo was sitting on its roof amongst shattered wood. Nightingale stopped to wait for me. "Is anyone looking in our direction?" I asked. Nightingale said he couldn't see anyone, so I turned away and found a convenient tree trunk, leaned over, and vomited. Once I'd started, I found I couldn't stop until what seemed like a month's worth of dinners had come back up. I was lightheaded and hollowed out when I'd finished. Nightingale gave me one of his cream-colored linen handkerchiefs, monogrammed and ironed by Molly to such a sharp edge I could have happily used it as a shuriken. I carefully unfolded it and used it to wipe my mouth. He didn't ask for it back. The Thames Valley Police were out in force at the house, including an armed response unit, who slouched against the sides of their Volvo V70 and glared at us on general principles. Then Stephanopoulos arrived and glared at them until they packed up and left, allowing me a brief respite before she came and glared at me. There was the requisite 3 hours of milling around as we waited for Socco and a specialist search team to go over the house and the inevitable arguments about who was going to find an all-night takeaway in High Wycombe for refs. Caroline's mum roared up the drive in her MG. Me and Caroline watched from the safety of the kitchen as Lady Helena pulled up and proceeded to castigate Nightingale for putting her baby in danger. While that was going on, Caroline beckoned me over and said she'd rather her mum didn't know about the almost flying. "I don't want her to worry," she said. "Worry about what?" I asked, but she wouldn't say. She waved at me as her mum drove her away. Martin Chorley's utilitarian office turned out to be less interesting than his study. He had every OS map of the British Isles ever published, going all the way back to the 19th century. Plus, a range of specialist maps and gazettes, some of which I recognized from my post-Herefordshire research, a couple of Edwardian earthwork surveys, The Old Straight Track by Alfred Watkins, and The Real Middle Earth, Magic and Mystery in the Dark Ages, which confirmed that Martin Chorley was an enormous Tolkien nerd. As if the 5 or 6 different editions of Lord of the Rings and the signed first edition of The Hobbit wasn't enough proof. He hadn't neglected the other inklings, though,
C.S. Lewis had a shelf, and he didn't have any objection to YA either, judging by the collection of Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising sequence. Again, first editions. But these ones far too well read to be worth much. Besides similarly worn copies of The Owl Service and the rest of Alan Garner's books. It wasn't exactly screaming, power-mad psychopath, although it was possible that he was modern enough to keep all his vices on a USB stick. Over the real fireplace, with all its original farmhouse stone trimmings, was a painting that one of the Sokos assured me was a genuine pre-Raphaelite masterpiece of the dying king surrounded by weeping queens variety, painted by one James Archer in the late 19th century.
Romantic, said Nightingale much, much later. The most dangerous people on earth.
Finally, me and Gulid caught a lift back to London, while Nightingale stayed at the house, on the off chance its owner popped back for something he'd forgotten. I wanted to spend the night at Bev's, but I needed to be central in case Martin Chorley did something viciously psychopathic in the middle of the night. As it happened, I got to sleep all the way to 9:30 the next morning, before the landline rang and Stephanopoulos told me that somebody had just tried to kill Olivia McAllister Thames. The house opposite Tyburn's place had obviously been built post-war, probably to replace bomb damage stock. Mercifully, it must have been quite late on because it wasn't the featureless box so favoured by the American modernists, and the architect had actually made an attempt to fit it in with the rest of the street. It still had a touch of the gun emplacement around the ground floor, and a marble-floored entrance hallway that managed to be both pretentious and dark at the same time. Once I was safely cocooned in my noddy suit, Stephanopoulos led me upstairs, to the third-floor flat, where the sniper had made his nest. I'd missed the body, which didn't bother me, but Stephanopoulos had a tablet stuffed full of crime scene photographs.
"We don't know who he is yet," she said. "White, mid-30s, fit, has a Foreign Legion tattoo, but that doesn't mean anything."
As police were always tripping over people with Special Forces tattoos that were more aspirational than indications of service.
"I'm hoping for distinctive teeth," said Stephanopoulos, although that was no longer the reliable guide to nationality it once was.
I'd been told that American dental work was still distinctly overwrought, whatever that meant with regards to teeth.
"Let's hope he wasn't American," I said.
"We didn't need any more about that complication, thank you very much." The flat was unfurnished, although in a distinctively expensive way, with marble flooring in the bathrooms, Italian tile in the kitchen, an expensive rosewood parquet in the rest. The nest was in what I'd call a living room, but was probably listed by the estate agent as the lounge. The firing position was a good 3 meters back from the bay windows. The central window had been opened and securely fastened, but with the curtains partly drawn, he'd have been in shadow, essentially invisible from across the street. The lack of furniture meant that he'd had to bring his own stand to rest the rifle on, the heavy-duty type serious anglers use for big fish. He even brought a camp stool, a couple of bottles of water, and a packet of Pret-a-Manger sandwiches. I imagined a couple of DCs were even now pulling the CCTV from every Pret within a kilometer. Damn, that was going to be a lot of Prets. I glanced around the empty room.
"He knew there wasn't any furniture," I said. "Even better, he had a legitimate set of keys," said Stephanopoulos. "And this property has had the same owner for 5 years.
"Let me guess," I said.
"Our old friend, Mr. Shell Company." "Oh, yes," said Stephanopoulos, "which is a close relative to A.N. Other Shell Company and a Guernsey-registered investment house who bought it on behalf of one James Hodgkins, a.k.a. Martin Chorley."
I looked across the street to what I'd been assured was Tyburn's bedroom, obscured now by the blue sheeting the forensic people had rigged to cover the shattered window. Less than 30 meters, I thought. A good sniper would barely need a telescopic sight. The gun had been whisked away even before the body. An L96A1, firing a standard 7.62mm NATO round. It was the standard British sniper rifle, as used by the Army, the Navy, and the Met's own SCO-19.
Probably, Stephanopoulos said, one of those guns that occasionally fall off the back of a military supply lorry. A bit specialist for your basic London underworld, who tended to favour cheaper and more personal forms of assassination. Although if I'd been planning to take a shot at Lady Tai myself, I'd probably have opted for a drone strike from a nice air-conditioned Air Force base in Arizona. And even then, I'd do it under an assumed name. He'd got off only the one shot before he died. It was a bolt-action weapon, but still, I would have thought he'd have the time to take a second one, just to be on the safe side. 3 hours later, they still hadn't found the bullet he'd fired. What killed him? I asked.
Single stab wound to the chest with a heavy double-edged blade, said Stephanopoulos. Through his heart and out the other side.
What, through the ribs?
Sheared right through two at the front and one at the back, she said. Clean cut.
A sword, I said.
That's what they think, but they haven't finished the PM yet.
If I had to guess, I'd have said a classic 14th century English arming sword, like the one I'd once seen worn by a young man in a hallucination I'd had when I was busy suffocating under the eastbound Central Line platform. A young man who styled himself Sir William Tyburn, who had been god of the river from back when it was a wild stream rushing down to Father Thames. For obvious reasons, I kept this intriguing observation to myself.
Chorley's had this place for 5 years, said Stephanopoulos. Never had any tenants in here in all that time.
He knew about the rivers, I said. He must have thought it would be handy to have a way of keeping them under surveillance. Or perhaps he'd known that sooner or later he was going to have to go mano a dios with Lady Tai.
Still not a bad little investment over 5 years, I suppose, said Stephanopoulos. But why a sniper? It's not his M.O.
If he wanted Olivia dead, he knew he'd have to go through her mother first, I said. And he knew he had to take Tyburn down before she was aware of the attack. Otherwise, Lady Tai, this close to her river, this close to the Thames, not going to happen. I looked across at the blinded window opposite. He can't possibly have missed at that range, I said.
And yet he's the one who's dead, said Stephanopoulos. Could she have thrown a sword across that distance?
I tried to imagine Tyburn pivoting smartly on her heel, bringing her arm back, and flinging a sword across the gap between the houses like a bad special effect. The sniper staggering back, looking down in amazement as half the blade and the pommel vibrate amusingly in his chest. Not enough star points for Tyburn. And anyway, they never found the sword. If she threw it, I said, then who pulled it out? Stephanopoulos gave the traditional short sigh of the senior officer who was about to explain something they thought was bleeding obvious right from the start of the conversation, but obviously wasn't.
No offence, Peter, she said, but we're kind of relying on you to provide that information. Us being normal run-of-the-mill coppers, none of who are versed in the mystic arts or currently shagging a supernatural creature.
That you know of, boss, I said, thinking of Wanda the manageress, who you wouldn't spot as special if you didn't know what to look for. But Stephanopoulos was right. This was the Follies' area of expertise, and it was embarrassing that we were so bloody crap at it. Assume for the moment that the dead sniper had something to do with laughing Sir Tyburn, thought dead by his father and brothers these last 150 years. But we know that apparent remnants of normal human beings can be left behind, and under particular circumstances can physically interact with the mundane world. Do gods have ghosts? I wondered. If they did, wouldn't they be much more powerful than those left behind by people? Or was that a typical first-order assumption? Probably, I thought. And yet, if we stayed with that idea, then surely the world would be full of these powerful ghosts of former gods. Now, I hadn't come across anything like that in my literature, and while my predecessors in the craft were often thicker than a bag full of custard, I think even they would have noticed something like that. Perhaps, I thought, the dead god gets folded into the existence of the new god, the way a dormant genetic variation can exist within an organism's DNA, hanging about like an actor's understudy until the right environmental conditions give it expression and, hey presto, suddenly, a bacteria is heat resistant. Our Chloe gets her big break on Broadway, and A Sniper for Hire gets an unexpected half meter of cold steel through the chest. Perhaps that explained why the rivers of London had burst forth with new goddesses so quickly after Mama Thames took up her throne. Perhaps there was more than historical continuity between the dead sons of old Father Thames and the daughters that had taken their place. And a certain river on the Welsh borders where me and Beverly had been catalysts in the creation of a new spirit, a new genius loci, a new god. Shit, I thought. I've just invented epideism. Peter, said Stephanopoulos, you still with us? Oh, God, I said. I think I prefer being a frog. And then before Stephanopoulos had a chance to clip me round the ear for being obscure, I told her I'd have to do some digging on the subject. But we still need to see if they find any metal fragments in the wound track, I said, and reminded myself to ask Dr. Vaughan to do the most sensitive test she could, because if she couldn't find any, then it was possible that the sniper had been stabbed with a sword that didn't physically exist. What had definitely existed was the water that had erupted out of the street in front of Lady Ty's house. A burst water main, according to Thames Water, who said they'd get back to us as to why it had chosen to burst at just the moment Mr. Sniper was getting an invisible sword stuck through his chest. Tyburn Street had a noticeable slope north to south, and you could see from the water damage where the flood had risen outside her front door and rolled downhill across Curzon Street, down the passage under Curzonfield House, before emptying out onto Shepherd Market, much to the surprise of the shop workers who'd been sitting on benches having a quiet fag at the time. It was 2 feet deep, said Stephanopoulos. This was confirmed by some of the eyewitnesses, especially those on the dry end of the street. Statements from witnesses downstream were, as Sewell put it, less than fucking useful. One woman who'd been carried away and deposited outside the RBS branch on Curzon Street said that the water had been much cleaner than she'd expected, and that she thought she smelt meadow grass.
Meadow grass? Meadow grass, said Stephanopoulos. One word. She was very insistent, and that's not the strangest statement.
Amina Assad, who'd been one of the shop workers having a fag, said she'd sort of had a weird vision, you know, like a really vivid daydream, that she'd been stood waist-deep in a river washing clothes by hand.
By hand, she said again and laughed. Ah, that's going to fucking happen.
Some reported seeing fish in the water. Others, a young, fit-looking white boy in a loincloth.
He was laughing, said David Hansworth of Charnwood Drive, Walthamstow, who quite fancied getting the guy's number, you know. Should we ever catch up with him?
He had the coolest accent, according to Mr. Hansworth, who was convinced he'd been part of an elaborate bit of street theatre, like an actor doing Shakespeare.
Did he say whether the guy was carrying a sword?
I asked.
You know, said Stephanopoulos, we never thought to ask.
I added asking that question and following up the stranger eyewitness accounts to my personal action list. Martin Chorley must have waited for his chance. At a guess, he'd been downstairs in the foyer of the same building. The sniper would have been instructed to take the shot as soon as he had a clear bead on Lady Ty. The sound of the shot would have served as a signal. Then Chorley steps out onto the street and starts his attack, only to probably get washed away in the flood. Thankfully, the media were largely ignoring the flood, mainly because of the massive explosion that had blown out the first 2 floors of Tyburn's house. British Gas, who were a bit sensitive on the subject, were desperate to rule out a gas explosion. But the only alternative the fire brigade would commit to involved Semtex and a truly ridiculous amount of fertilizer. To my trained eye, it looked like somebody had tried to unzip the front facade and spray it left and right. They were still pulling bits of brick and rusticated stucco out of basement areas of houses 50 meters to each side. I reckoned I'd actually seen something like it once, in an old barn in Essex, from the other side.